I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Matthew Lazenreiter joins me again. We'll talk about broadcasting and some of the current affairs issues that he and his colleagues tackle over at the 180, the radio program hosted by Jim Brown on CBC Radio, which airs Sunday mornings, where Mr. Lazenreiter is a producer. I usually catch the rebroadcast on Monday afternoons at 2 p.m. here in Vancouver. They cover a wide variety of topics and from an often fascinating perspective. He was an associate producer over at the On the Coast program, and he hosted The Invisible Hand, a great economics program from 2012 that you can still download at iTunes. The Twitter handle is @Lazen_Reiter. The website for the 180 is at cbc.ca/180. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program and studios at WIRR, Matthew Lazenreiter. Mr. Lazenreiter, good morning.
Hello, Joseph. Thank you for having me back.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it. What's it like at the CBC at the moment? We've come off of a week or so from what I gather from you and your colleagues on Twitter. It seems like an awful time for all of you there.
It's a grim time, like any workplace would be if there are big and troubling cuts. It's not, you know, it's not a happy place at the moment. There's a lot going on around the CBC and about the CBC, and it's difficult. But actually, as I was bicycling here, I ran into Rob Zimmerman, who was just out in the neighborhood. Rob Zimmerman is
the newsreader, right?
The newsreader, the afternoon newsreader. Yeah. And so I stopped in the alleyway, and we had, you know, pretty much the typical CBC experience these days, where we talk about who we've heard has lost their job and what programs are losing positions and who's being kind of shuffled out and all of the great talent that's gone. And then the conversation ends with, yeah, it's still a pretty fantastic place to work. And so while it's dark and grim, you know, there are always people there who say, you know, whatever the powers that be do, it's our job to just keep going and make the best we can. And that's, it's always a kind of bittersweet vibe at the CBC. Things are bad, but we're doing important stuff and we're doing stuff that we love, and let's keep doing it.
I guess the most prominent name was that left last week was Shane Foxman.
Yeah.
And the two of you on the air, I mean, he and Quinn on the air were great. But there were moments when the two of you were on the air, mm-hmm. when you'd fill in, and that was great radio too.
Yeah, Shane Foxman and I had an interesting relationship on the air. Off the air, we were great friends. I shouldn't say were, because he's not dead. He's just looking for work. If anyone knows anything for Shane Foxman to do, you let us know. But for some reason, and I'm not sure how it happened, but he built up this persona when Stephen Quinn was hosting, that for some reason he didn't like me. He would come in to do hits with yeah. sports with Stephen Quinn yeah. and make some comment about what I was or not doing that day or what I was wearing that day. And it kind of built this thing between Stephen and him that he didn't like me, and it was part of their banter. And so then when I ended up hosting On the Coast for a while, it only seemed natural for us to continue that kind of rivalry. And that was always the energy that happened when Foxman came in. And, you know, whenever we had the CBC open house and people would come by, unfortunately, I learned that people genuinely thought that Mr. Foxman and I really, really hated each other, which is unfortunate because I love Shane Foxman and every little bit about him. And it's very sad to see him leave the CBC.
You can tell when someone's good on the air, even if they have to do, say, 2 minutes or three. I don't know how long those segments were. Sometimes they would go on longer because yep. it was just so good, right? Because yep. sometimes the person just comes in, drops in, does their little promo, yep. and then walks out. But he, you know, he'd stick around for interviews sometimes, and he was totally. Just... And you can tell from those little moments, because I'm sure those weren't planned out, lunch, mm-hmm. saying, you know, you're going to come in at 4:30 or whatever and do this, just how gifted he was, or yes. is. Yeah, and I remember him from television, so that's my first experience with Mr. Foxman. That's from TV.
Yeah, Shane's what we call an accordion. This is in radio speak. I'm not sure if anyone called Shane an accordion to his face, but an accordion is someone who is really, really good at talking to time long and short. So when you're making live radio involves a lot of math and a lot of numbers and timing things out on the fly. And sometimes there's a great deal of uncertainty, and you don't know whether you'll have to fill a whole bunch of time with basically baloney because something's gone wrong or someone hasn't showed up or something happened in the great math scheme that is live radio. And Shane, one of Shane's great talents, was saying, Shane, something's gone wrong. We need you to fill 7 minutes. And he would do it. And he would do it, and not in a kind of baloney way. He would immediately give you 7 minutes of interesting, good radio. He's an accordion. He can stretch and he can shrink.
Yeah. But it's not just people like him that are who are gone. There's some other folks that we may not know of, like technical people, I'm sure.
Yeah. We've lost a few technicians. There are other kind of behind-the-scenes positions eliminated. There are, fewer people working at the CBC today than last week in all areas.
But it'll continue, it'll plod on, and it'll make as good radio as we're used to?
It will continue to exist, and the people that remain will still attempt to make the best radio possible.
You've been at the 180 for how long now?
Ooh, 8 months.
Yeah. And it seems like a natural fit from you, having gotten to know you on Twitter. Because a lot of the subjects that you used to tweet about are subjects or areas that you are now producing segments for on the 180.
Right.
It just seems like, and would you tell people who are listening to us who may not have listened to this program, this hour every Sunday or Monday as I listen to it, what you guys do there?
Sure. Well, it's still kind of new, and especially in its current time slot. And I have a feeling that the show will kind of grow and change the longer it exists. But our idea is, when we looked at all of the things going on that you can hear on CBC Radio, we found there was very little time for actual kind of pure opinion. And what you tend to hear on CBC Radio currently that sounds like opinion is either conclusions and analysis based on expertise. So something will happen in the news. We'll have some kind of expert offer their expertise or analysis of that thing. Or someone who's had a life experience that we think people could find something valuable in, and someone gives us their story or something. Sometimes, but not often, do you get pure opinion, like an argument based on personal values. So that's the main idea behind the 180, is this is a place where CBC listeners can hear someone's pure kind of value-based opinion. And that's the concept. That's the main one. The other is kind of unexpected viewpoints from people. So a person who has one kind of position in life has a viewpoint that you might not associate with that position. And the other one is just kind of underlooked stories throughout the week that might be interesting. But essentially it's supposed to be, and it will change, like I said, but that's the goal, is an opinion show.
Yeah, and it's because on the subject of the Supreme Court, for example, which a lot of people are talking about nowadays, in the last year or so. It's a great way to see what's actually going on, but not just the old, the Supreme Court said this today,
right,
and Harper and his government said this today.
Yeah.
There's something about, say, the institution itself, and you do that, I guess, in the Democracy Hack series.
That's right.
About how to improve these, I don't know what you call them, these elements of our democracy, so to speak.
Like with the Supreme Court, there are things you can say about it that don't involve opinion, right? Someone can offer their analysis that one judgment fits into the frame of what the Supreme Court is supposed to do, or one judgment kind of misinterpreted the Constitution or the Charter of Rights according to someone else. Not very often is there a place to hear, I think we should abolish or get rid of the Supreme Court because these values I have run contrary to it. And instead of analysis and expertise, a kind of value-based argument, which is there's a there for 1 hour a week, there's a good place for.
Yeah. On the Supreme Court, we're always hearing on the news about where the court is as opposed to where the government is.
Right.
And they're usually at either end of whatever issue it is.
Sure.
What do you think the public is?
On the value of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, or on just issues of, like, wherever there are contrasts between, the Harper government and the Supreme Court and whatever judgments they render.
It's a tough thing to say. I mean, I have seen recent polling that I don't have the particular stats of off the top of my head that say people Canadians tend to view the Supreme Court with more credibility than elected politicians, which is an interesting dynamic. I'm not sure it's quite the same in a lot of countries. But we tend to, and this is my understanding, and I don't have the kind of pure numbers off the top of my head, but the polling says that the Canadians trust the Supreme Court more than elected politicians of any stripe, which is interesting. So my impression of probably where the general sentiment is that, the string of decisions against the government in this case is probably a reasonable thing. But it's also the law, so it's kind of hard to argue with it.
Yeah, and do you find that there are similarities between how we think of our Supreme Court as to say how the Americans think about theirs?
I'm not sure on the specifics, but my kind of subjective interpretation of how people view the American Supreme Court is more political and politicized than the Canadian Supreme Court. That they are far more focused on who's a Democrat appointee and a Republican appointee than we are. I mean, our Supreme Court has three most recent conservative appointees. We don't particularly talk about that much. We say the Supreme Court has done this about this piece of legislation.
On issues that you've talked about on the 180, that you've produced about, I guess, on the 180. We hear you from time to time on the 180. How much of your own thinking is either formed or clarified after producing a certain segment?
Oh, that is a good question. And it's a really interesting question about journalism and journalists in general. I would say almost everything, because I know, maybe this sounds weird, a lot of journalists pretend or contend that they know everything already.
No.
And they're going to, among everything they know, they've picked a few perspectives to show you that day to illuminate something. And I'm happy to admit that every piece of radio or journalism I have ever put together, I have learned an immense amount. And that's one of the most exciting things about journalism. You learn everything. You learn a lot of things about a lot of things. So I would say everything. Every story I've ever done, I've come away myself with a better understanding of political dynamics, of how the Supreme Court runs things, of economics, of anything we ever do.
And if it were up to you and you could produce anything and everything you'd want to do, what would it be on? The monarchy?
I'm not sure about the monarchy.
Because I remember you'd sneak in segments from time to time on the Coast.
I do. That is a favorite subject of mine. it's not something that I think people want to hear all the time, but I am very interested in the monarchy, about how Canadians feel about the monarchy, about whether we even think or talk about the monarchy at all.
See, that's the other thing that I'm curious about and specifically on the monarchy, but when you produce these segments for the 180, do you find on the subject of the monarchy that we're talking about it as much as we should?
That is another good question. I think for now we are. There will be a time when we need to talk about it more. And that's naturally when it looks clear that Elizabeth is ending her time.
Don't you think
Earth.
That's a little too late, though?
Maybe, but I don't think... I think that will be the impetus for the discussion.
Yeah.
That Charles is about to be on the Canadian 20. That's what will get people talking. I'm not sure if there's a huge appetite to talking about it right now, but if you say it, if a thing happens that causes people to think about the monarchy's role in Canadian society. That's what will get people talking. So we're going to say, Prince Charles is going to be on your quarters, everybody. Prince Charles is going to be on your 20. Prince Charles is going to be the King of Canada, unless something happens right now.
Yeah.
Then it's the time to talk about it. I would like it if people were more interested, but I don't think that people are interested in the... Plus, also, I'm very interested in the constitutional element of the monarchy, which is a very difficult thing I've found to get people to get really riled up about. It's fascinating. There's a lot of interesting things about what the monarchy means to the structure of the Canadian state. But I know, in my heart of hearts, that many people don't share that passion.
I've got a shelf actually down the hall of books on Edward VIII and the abdication.
Ah.
And that's, for me, fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. Especially, I'm not sure if this is in it, but the relating to Canada.
Yeah.
That was one of the strange times where Canada had a different king than the United Kingdom. Because, telegrams were going back and forth. And for a while, Edward was the king of Canada and not the king
of Britain.
And it's an exciting time. And things had to happen. And for a while there, it looked like there was a constitutional argument that Kate's firstborn, mm-hmm. had she been a woman, would end up being the queen of the United Kingdom. And if Kate had a second child, who was a son, constitutionally, there was an argument that that son would become the King of Canada, mm-hmm. Because of the differences in law and constitutional relationship with the crown in Canada and Britain. So even as I'm saying that, I feel like really excited talking about it, but I always wonder if people actually care about that stuff as much as we might find it fascinating.
Yeah, and I guess the point is moot, because she did have a son.
She did have a son, so it could be a whole another generation to live.
Until we have to think about this, yeah.
Yeah.
On Twitter, I get the sense from following you that you have this sense of history, this appreciation of history, and that's important in your work. I mean, it's one thing to report a story,
mm-hmm.
and whatever's happening today with the government, but we need to have context, and you often highlight the context, the historical context, which I think is important. When we talk about politics,
mm-hmm.
in our discourse, in our culture, do you think we lack, say, a sense of history? I mean, there's a lot of people in the media now who are, say, our age,
mm-hmm.
younger. Do you think that's a detriment to, say, how the news is reported and having that historical context behind it?
It is, again, that's a challenging question, because having, as I'm sure you would agree, having a sense of history lets you know about the meaning behind the things that we value and care about in the structure of our politics. If journalists in general had a better sense of kind of the history of the development of Canada, it would make clear a lot of our conversations about federations and the power of premiers and how much power the federal government should have, which is conversations that we actually don't have that often in media. The conversation ends up being a kind of, catfights between the federal government and premiers instead of what I would guess people used to do in the earlier evolution of our country, which is talk about in an open way, how much power should our provinces have? What should be their jurisdiction? How do they all get together? We talk about Canada as if it existed in its current form all the time. A general sense of history could and would be better. And I'm not a historical expert. I mean, there are plenty of journalists who know more about history than I do, especially, local political history. I'm not particularly...
But you bring a curiosity that I think is lacking. And my only example is I talked to someone the other day off the air, who's younger than I am, 24, 25 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I just offhand mentioned Socred.
Right.
And they didn't know what a Socred was. And I immediately felt old. But I mean, in 1991, when they lost the government here in BC,
yeah.
I would have been 9. So, right. so I probably shouldn't know what a Socrate is either.
Oh, but no, you should.
I've availed myself to history, so, you know.
You but, should know what a Socrate is.
But I mean, so that this 25-year-old person didn't. And, right. and I don't know, I felt kind of, I don't know, I felt weird about it.
It is weird, I mean.
Weird enough that I'm bringing it up to you in conversation.
It's weird. You should know what a Socrate is. You should know what the CCF mm-hmm. was. There are a lot of things that in BC and federal politics it would be handy to know of. But then again, on the other hand, what does a 25-year-old need to know about the Socrates? They're gone, or maybe they still have a website somewhere. There is someone still calling themselves the Socrates, aren't there?
Yeah, there is. There's the woman. She runs every election in Hastings.
Ah, that's the
forget her name now. Yeah. But you see, the other thing, too, is that this past weekend, I read in the paper, Leslie Peterson died. And mm-hmm. he was an old Socrate going back to the W.A.C. Bennett days. Mm-hmm. And I tweeted, and I said, he's probably the last Socrate alive. And then Keith Baldry said, no, I probably Grace McCarthy is the last.
All right. Yeah.
But it's funny how these things are so much a part of our province, and yet
yes.
a generation later, they're gone.
Yeah, but that's kind of the fun part about politics in a way. I mean, the Liberals were gone in B.C. for mm-hmm. a while. And now they exist mm-hmm. in their current form, which is interesting. And, you know, one day the NDP will be gone, and one day the Conservative Party will be gone, and one day the Federal Liberal Party will be gone, and we'll be, you know, we'll have the space Liberals and the the future Tories. That's the fun part about politics is parties get to a point where they're out of touch with what they intended to do, and things fall apart, and then they regroup and start again, like the current federal Conservatives.
Now, we started the conversation about the CBC and the stuff that you're all within the CBC are going through. When there are cutbacks, as there have been, and it seems to be a regular occurrence now every year or so, do we lose, say, that background, maybe that history? I mean, because everyone seems to be coming into this institution, you know, the whoever's coming to this institution, I should say, is younger, maybe.
Well,
but that's not just the CBC to pick on the CBC. I mean, that's every other outlet, I suppose.
Sometimes, I mean, I think often the opposite happens. Is in cases like the CBC, what can happen is. You have younger people losing their jobs and older people with seniority staying around. And I'm not saying that is better than the alternative, but it's one of the consequences is you retain experience and knowledge and all of that stuff. You lose the kind of new perspectives and new blood and new energy and vitality. And to me, and I'm careful to not make any judgments about the political decisions that currently guide the CBC. But to me, that is one of the dangers of what's currently going on with the CBC is that now more than any time we need fresh blood. We need exciting, fresh, vigorous people. I think we have enough experience in the CBC. I think we have enough people who remember the Socrates at the CBC.
Well, that's good.
I think we could use some fresh blood, and it's difficult because we're draining all our fresh blood. But probably, I mean, and you're right, every newsroom is slimming down. You know, there are great people losing their jobs in all areas of mainstream media, and with that goes knowledge and experience and understanding and incisiveness.
To that point, me as a news consumer, am I well served by the media that I'm surrounded by in this community, in this market?
I think so. Of course, it's not perfect. If I had my druthers, like I'm a news consumer as well and a believer in the power of journalism, if I had my druthers, we'd have a lot more journalists and reporters. But in the grand scheme of things, I think BC and Canada is well served by our media. I think we've got great media. If you compare to the United States and the UK, for example, I think our media in general is pretty damn good. And in BC, BC has a lot of really great journalists who care a lot about local issues. And the market leader in television, Global, which used to be BC TV,
mm-hmm.
and they do a fantastic newscast, and they have a kind of relationship with BCers that is hard to come by, that kind of in your community, we're one of you kind of things that is very, very valuable. CBC focuses on kind of investigative and kind of high impact stories, that's also very, very valuable. And what I find about the kind of BC media scene is there's a lot of that. There's focusing on strengths. And I think it is very valuable. And as much as every media institution and journalist that has a Twitter account is complaining about how media is dying and cutting, I think Canadian media and BC media and Vancouver media is doing the job of serving the public very well.
Now, you're a producer. You produce segments for the radio. One of the things that I found fascinating is this discussion that's been happening over at TVO's The Agenda with regards to how the sorts of guests that they're booking.
Mm-hmm.
I forget her name now. She's married to David Mitchell. I've interviewed her before. She runs a sort of organization that puts people on programs.
Right.
And strictly female, mm-hmm. because she believes that there aren't enough female guests on the air. And so this happened maybe 2 years ago or so, and she went on Pakin's show, and they talked about how Pakin also did an analysis of his guests, and there weren't enough women. He said recently that they've taken it to about 48% or so, female guests as opposed to male guests. And then there was an article in the National Post, a column in the National Post, saying that, sure, that's great, but there isn't enough ethnic diversity amongst the guests that appear on that particular program. So to use The Agenda as an example, I'm sure you run into this when you're booking guests for whatever you're producing.
Yeah.
Do you think about these things, about whoever you're putting on and whether they... I mean, the word quota is a terrible word, but just so that the voices on whatever program you're producing are sort of representative of, say, the community? And does it have to be?
That is a big, big, huge question and could take hours to discuss, and I'm happy to do it.
Well, we're on the internet, so we don't have...
we don't have time here. So, I mean, here's the thinking. We talk about that. Every journalist talks about that all the time. Every radio producer, when you're looking at your show and putting together a show, you talk about it constantly. Because it's a really, really big, interesting issue. And the issue is, how much should... I guess the first issue is, does it matter, right? Does it matter if your media looks and sounds like the general makeup of the population? Or not even that, because the general, you know, still, the general makeup of the Canadian population en masse is pretty white. So the conversation is, how much of the people that you see on television and the people that you hear on the radio should be representative of all of the peoples that happen to be in Canada, and the genders and the gender identities and all of those things. I believe it is important that media, especially the CBC, which we all pay for, is representative of everybody in Canada, not just in the guests that we have on the air, but in the faces that are bringing you the news and the voices that are bringing you the news. And there are a number of reasons. One is inclusiveness. So one of the reasons why people say, okay, we need to have more women or more ethnic diversity, is not to say, not tokenism, not to say, look at us, we're being PC or whatever, but it's to say, on a kind of emotional level to the people watching, we're here for you. This is a place for you. You're not going to hear a bunch of white people talking about issues because you may find that inaccessible. And again, I don't know whether or not that is accessible or inaccessible is a subject of huge debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hit the microphone and I apologize. But that's the thinking, that this is a place for everybody. And if you are of one ethnicity or nationality or gender identity, there are people like you working with us. So we've heard your perspectives. We have heard your way of looking at things. That's part of what we talk about in the newsroom, is your perspectives. So we are a place for you. And the other part making sure that we actually do reflect and you're right, quotas is bad. It's a bad word. It's not a good word because it sounds like it's dishonest.
It sounds like that's the only thing you have to fulfill.
Exactly.
I mean, you as long as this person fits this description, they could talk nonsense, but we've fulfilled that mandate, if you will.
Yeah. So we want to make sure that if you're interviewing a doctor on mainstream media, there's a big chance that that doctor is going to be white. If you're interviewing a university professor, there's a big chance that that university professor is going to be a white male. Now, how that ends up, that the white male university professor ends up being the media person, the I'll talk to the media about my expertise person, is there's a lot of things that go into it. But we all know that there are plenty of non-white, non-male university professors and researchers and doctors and stuff doing all of these things. And so I do believe that media should make an effort to accurately reflect all of the various perspectives that make up a profession or a movement or a philosophy or anything. And that involves saying, we're going to try and find a female X or Y to represent on this story.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's great debate about whether we should do that or not, but that is what I believe, that it serves the purpose to say our media institution is here for you, and also here's what reality looks like.
And so this is something that you're actively thinking about.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always looking for people to talk to, I suppose.
Yep.
And because I made a list here of people that we always see in the media, you know.
Yeah.
Like, what's the guy, the professor at SFU?
Mark Jackert?
Oh, yeah, him too.
I like Mark Jackert. Mark Jackert's great, but he happens to be a white male.
But, if you want to talk about, say, the Middle East or something, what's that guy?
Boudreaux?
No, that's the English professor.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Andre Gerlamatos.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We always see him. We always see Lindsay Meredith. We always see, if we were talking about the Canucks and playoff tickets, we always see the guy selling Kingsley Bailey.
Yeah.
You know, we're always seeing these same people.
That's right.
So
it's a huge challenge.
I'm not saying that any of these guys are terrible.
No, they're great people that have a lot to offer the world, but... Are they the only ones that are
picking up the phone, I guess, when people call?
Right? There are other marketing professors. There are female marketing professors of various ethnicities out there. Lindsay Meredith tends to be on more than others. And how that happens, I'm not sure. And Lindsay Meredith is a fantastic guy, and I like talking to him. So... I imagine that there's stuff that needs to change on every level. And I think that there's probably stuff that needs to change on the university level. Because I'm not sure how many of your listeners know this, but universities try very, very hard to get their people on the radio. And universities on their own identify experts and suggest them to the media.
Especially if something is, if say, Catherine is going to have a baby shortly.
Right.
There's going to be someone that you can either talk to at UBC or SFU that they've already said.
They've set this up. They've got great marketing people at universities, so they find the person. And so, quite honestly, and I mean no disrespect to the good people that are... institutions, but so there needs to be something there. There they need to do more work to find people of various ethnicities and genders to be that kind of expertise. I have heard some discussion among, because I was speaking with some economists about this issue, and some discussion that goes along these lines. And again, this is going to be one of those things where I say I have absolutely no evidence to back it up. But these are the anecdotes that I've heard about university life, sure, and who gets to talk to the media and why there seems to be a gender imbalance. What I heard and the feeling that I heard was that men are more comfortable spouting bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that's why they end up on television and radio, is because they don't mind. And this is kind of gender essentialism, I get it. But men, in general, more than women, feel like they can just get away with spouting bullshit. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm saying a lot of media is bullshit, but I think a lot of people are afraid to speak with the media for fear of saying something wrong or incorrect or whatever. And so men may be more comfortable going on the radio and talking to the television cameras, mm-hmm, because just in case something comes up that they don't know, men are perhaps more inclined to just kind of make some crap up. I don't think it happens that often, but what it essentially it means is that men are just more comfortable kind of letting it all hang out, as it were, and perhaps women are a little more cautious about their facts and the things that they want to be very clear to say. This is not my experience. This is just what I heard from a few.
And that's what that woman who runs that, it's called Informed Opinions, and I'm ransacking my brain trying to think what her name is. Hmm. She says that that's her experience, that men are more willing to appear on television or on the radio because they can get away with saying things like that.
Right, and women tend to be more cautious.
More circumspect, yeah.
Right. Which isn't really good, because really we should encourage everyone to be like men, quite honestly, in that sense. Like, everyone should feel free to speak with the media at all times and not worry about having to say, I don't know the answer to that thing, or, you know, I don't have all the facts, but here's my belief based on what I do know. And I think that's part of what needs to change in media as well, is we need to stop expecting people to be the ultimate authorities on things, because if it allows, and if these things are at all true, that men just feel more free to make judgments or express values if women tend to be more conservative in that regard, then I think that's something we could change across the board, is that media should or can be a little more relaxed about letting people say, I don't know the answer to that, please ask me something else.
On interviewing, because you've done a lot of interviewing in your career thus far, do you find that someone asked me the other day, when I ask people questions, because this is what I do regularly, how many questions I ask of a guest do I know the answer to? Mm. And sometimes you have to know what the guest is going to say, mm-hmm, especially if you're talking to a politician or something like that. That's par for the course if you've done your research, right? Do you mind if we talk about interviewing? Because I've never gone to school for interviewing, so this is for me. This will be informative for me to get your perspective. Do you find that when you're producing an interview segment, that when you find someone who's willing to talk to you and willing to get on the air with you or whatever, that there is a special skill in terms of making them feel comfortable on the air?
Yep. Absolutely.
And if they're not comfortable, does that preclude them automatically from say being the guest?
It depends. Sometimes you'll encounter someone, say, this is the perfect interview, let's get them on the radio, and you set everything up, and then circumstances change, and they suddenly become, when they realize that they're going to be speaking to the entire country, or at least 1 million people in the country, that changes their feelings, and they become a little more restricted in the things that they want to say. Sometimes a lot of people are just raring to go when you get them on the radio. But comfort is an interesting thing. There is an interviewing technique that's called the Sawatsky technique. I'm not sure if you've ever encountered that name.
He's the guy that I think he used to write for The Sun.
He used to write for a lot of places. He used to. He ended up
at ESPN.
Yeah, at ESPN as a kind of consultant for interviewing.
Yeah.
But the Sawatsky approach is, in a sense, a lot about comfort, about building a kind of connection and rapport and understanding with your interview subject to make them feel comfortable. Kind of the hope is that when you get into that zone with an interview guest where your first couple of questions build a kind of relationship about how a person feels on that particular day about a particular thing. And the idea is hopefully when you're kind of building that relationship that for them the rest of the world will kind of fall away and they'll forget they're in a radio studio and it'll just kind of turn to black. They'll forget that the sounds they're making are being recorded into a thing or broadcast to the world. And you end up doing what is really, really hard to do in a radio atmosphere, which is end up having an actual conversation with someone. And the benefit of the Sawatsky approach is that after you build that kind of rapport and you kind of got your arm around them and you're walking along the beach in a conversational sense, at some point, you can slowly guide them over to the cliff that they don't want to walk off, but they've forgotten it's there, and eventually they'll kind of fall off that cliff of their own regard. Basically, if there's something that you know a person will say that is controversial or damaging or in some way not in their best interest to say, but is the God's honest truth, and the public would be better off hearing it, and all of society would be better off hearing it, and you know that's the one thing that they don't want to say. It's a handy technique to kind of build that relationship and slowly build up to that question, so they feel when that question of, so did you kill your wife, or how are you feeling when you killed your wife, that their defenses are kind of worn down, and they will tell you, I felt really relieved when I killed my wife.
This seems like a very lengthy process.
It's a long process.
Yeah. So how does that work if you're producing, say, a live show that and the story is breaking news, say?
Well, the Sawatsky...
Does that go out the window?
I mean... You can. I mean, it's... That kind of, like, build a real conversation is something you have to really plan for, and you have to have the time to do it. A really quick, like, breaking news, get someone on the phone, that's really more just open-ended questions. You know, there are things you want to know from people. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? What are you smelling? And that's it. Although I do tend to think that people often overthink interviews.
And that's why you're probably not getting, say, a wide diversity of guests.
Exactly. But I think journalists overthink interviews in some sense. I think there's a lot of pressure to come up with really cutting, cunning, biting questions. And sometimes the most valuable questions are, what happened? Why'd you do that? Where did you go after? You know, those are questions that anyone could answer, and people tend to be more comfortable with those questions. It's tough to come up with the right kind of tone, but I mean, if you're talking with someone about, you've grabbed someone on the phone at the scene of a train crash, the only thing you want to ask that person is, what are you seeing? What's happening? Where were you when it happened? What does it sound like there? What does it smell like there? That's it. That's an interview that requires, you know, it doesn't require research because nobody knows anything. You're using someone as your research. And I do think sometimes people overthink those kinds of things and ask questions about, you know, what kind of train is it and what are the police saying will be the time that they'll get the thing cleared and, you know, all that stuff that nobody really cares about people care about what happened and what's going on.
In terms of interviewers that you like, because I guess my only experience in terms of interviewing and ending up doing this, as I have for the last 10 years or so, is from watching people, some of the people you see on the wall here. I've sort of learned from, stolen from.
Right.
For you, who are the interviews that you like?
I would say probably the most influential to me is Catherine Gretzinger, who used to host the afternoon show, which became On the Coast on CBC Radio. Probably, and I'm going to maybe upset a few people, but probably the best interviewer I have heard on CBC Radio. And really, really got that, that if you want to hear the truth from someone, you have to understand them and you have to kind of get on the same level as them and make them comfortable and empathize with them. She could empathize with a serial killer cannibal, and she could do it in a way that nobody could, and that everyone who walked into that studio, she would, it was just like she would open up her chest and like a beam of light would shoot out and she would make a kind of weird ethereal communion with this person. And that's the kind of interview I really like. People have different preferences and stuff, but I really like an interview that gets to the, that allows a person to expose their guts. That's what I like.
And do you find there's a difference whether they're on the phone or in the person or in person?
Yeah, totally. People are never comfortable on the phone. People, it's easier for people to lie on the phone.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I only started interviewing people in person when there was one particular person who insisted on doing it, and so I had to get another mic and all that. But for the first, say, 7 years of this thing, everyone was on the phone. And one of the people that I've stolen from is Don Imus, and he's always said that it was easier to talk to people on the phone because their guard was down. They were either at home, say, or in the hotel room sitting, and they would say things on the phone that they wouldn't say in person. And this is the other thing that I've noticed in talking to people now in person, is that I guess it's easier to talk to people that you've never met in person.
Right.
Let's say if I know someone and I'm having them on, we're talking, it's probably easier to talk to them on the phone because then at that moment I can get something out of them that I wouldn't have gotten in person.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is, I mean, just the aesthetics of it. I mean, you know, I couldn't talk to you, say, having just woken up and stumbling down here in my pajamas, right?
Yeah.
And I did have to, you know, tidy up. So there's that aspect of it, I guess. But
yeah, that's interesting. In my experience, I've found that people, it's more difficult to get people to crack open on the phone. It's easier for people to feel a kind of intellectual distance. And so lie on the phone, basically. And when I say lie, I mean, you know, in the journalistic kind of lie, like not quite giving you the truth. So that's interesting, and maybe other people feel the same way. Personally, I've as a host and a producer, I've found that an interview you know could get the subject and the audience crying their hearts out if that person was in studio wouldn't do the same.
If you're a producer, you'd have to get them coffee. You'd have to, you know, make sure they were there on time. I mean, it's a lot more complicated, don't you think?
It's a lot more complicated. Well, let me give you an example. We used to have this studio at the CBC called Studio 5, which is where Sounds Like Canada. You remember Sounds Like Canada?
Oh, yeah.
Sounds Like Canada came out of Studio 5, and it was this big, it's not really a studio anymore, but it was in the kind of the basement of...
In the old building,
the old building. Yeah. Well, it's still there. I mean, the building is still there. It's just got that whole new glass box on the outside. So in the basement, and it was kind of like a living room in there. So it had this kind of round table with a bunch of mics, but it was a big space. And it had some couches and nice lamps and really nice lighting with the lamps. And we ended up calling it the Magic Studio because the vibe in there was so nice that it really got people to open up. One of the problems that we found is when we recorded interviews in there is things tended to kind of lull a bit because it was such a relaxing atmosphere. But it was very, very good for getting people to kind of crack open. And I remember one really fantastic interview we did with Mike DeYoung, currently BC. He was the public safety minister after the Jukansky report came out.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm misremembering this. Was it Jukansky or was it Picton? Ruh-da-da-da-da. Anywho.
He was in the government and he was speaking on behalf of the government,
right?
Yeah.
At some point during Picton or...
Sometime in the Liberal government.
Sometime in the past.
In a position of authority, Mr. DeYoung comes
in. And so we knew that we'd heard him talk about the report because the report was very critical. Let's just say it was Picton. Maybe I'm wrong. Let's just say it was Picton. But the report was very critical of various things that police did and the province did and local governments did. And it was not a good thing. And we had heard Mr. DeYoung do other interviews where he very competently and with consideration and respect for everyone involved admitted, you know, some kind of culpability on behalf of the government. But to us, it just didn't seem very satisfying. He still seemed to be being a politician and not a human being. And so we did this strategy where we said, okay, we're going to interview him later today. Let's take him down to Studio 5 and have it be a really long interview, because then he can't say, we accept the conclusions of this report and we promise to do better in the future. Not that he was being cold and distant, but we just knew there was more. We knew he could be a real human. And so we said, let's take him down to Studio 5. And he came in that day to record. And this was Stephen Quinn on the Coast. And we took him down to Studio 5. And I think maybe we just said, like, the regular studio's getting cleaned or something. And it ended up being one of the best political interviews I had ever heard. And there was something about that atmosphere and the color of the lights, the nice amber lamps in there, and the quiet atmosphere that Minister DeYoung kind of cracked open. And you could tell that he felt things about lives that had been lost based on political decisions, not decisions that he made, but decisions that governments had made. And he felt bad about those losses and understood the pain and suffering that was in the community. And he sounded, and we ended up talking to him for about 40 minutes and sounded, which is what everyone wants them to sound when you talk to politicians, like a real human being. And it was really, really valuable and a great moment, because essentially that's what we want. When we talk about political spin, what we're really saying is we want you to sound like a normal human. We want you to have feelings and thoughts and cares and values. And that was one of those moments. And I don't think it would happen if we got, you know, DeYoung on the phone from his office or even in the regular kind of fluorescent lit studio. There was something about Studio 5 and the darkness and the lamps that allowed him. And it was good for him, too, right? Like, it was good for him to be able to sound like a human. And that's what happened. So, and I think that's the best thing. You can take, you know, politicians and lawyers and people that generally distrust, and given the right conditions and the right interview questions and the right kind of setup, and if everyone's on board, you can make them crack open and expose a little bit of their soul. And that's the best thing that could possibly happen.
How much of a good interview is incumbent on the host, say?
Probably 65%.
And then the rest is, say, the producer and the guest, or is it?
Rest is producer and the guest, I'd say. 65% host, 20% guest, 25%. Wait, does that add up to 100? Yes, it does. 25% producer.
Because math isn't. Is that a requirement for someone in journalism?
Wait, well, okay, let's do this.
60%, 20, and 20?
60, 20, and 20. Let's go with that.
All right. So that's the formula. The other thing, too, that I've noticed.
Wait. Let's go 60, 15, 20 guest, 15 producer before the interview, 5 producer after the interview when they're editing it.
Mm. So when you're talking, when Jim Brown, for example, talks to people, he's talking for them to them for a longer time than we hear. Is that
usually,
right?
Usually, yeah.
Yeah.
And usually about 20 minutes.
And he's in Calgary and you're in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
With a lot of phone calls.
Hmm.
A lot of phone calls, a lot of...
Skype and the sort? You do
some Skype, some, like instant messages and stuff.
So you can talk to him if he's on, say, the phone with someone?
Yeah, so if he's doing an interview,
yeah,
we're all kind of patched in, listening along and...
Is that how most programs, say, on the CBC, the network shows?
No. Well, The Current, so The Current, which is our flagship kind of morning, this is what's going on today show, they've got little groups of producers all over the country. So there's a team in Vancouver, there's a team in Toronto, there's a couple people in a lot of big cities around the country. Most shows, though, have a team in Toronto or Montreal or Regina or Vancouver or wherever.
And the show airs on Sundays,
mm-hmm.
so you probably don't do it on Sundays.
No, we do it. So we do it throughout the earlier week.
What if something breaks or something, or something that you've already taped has some element of the story has changed?
That's why we all can't sleep on Saturday night. So we all go to bed Saturday night hoping that nothing happens.
Yeah.
Oh, God, don't let anything happen on Saturday night. But by the nature of the show, I mean, we're looking for people's opinions on big things that people are generally batting around. So we won't talk about...
Say what happened at the Duffy trial?
What happened, if we talk about the Duffy trial, we'll talk about something big about the Duffy trial, not day-to-day developments that might change or might get derailed or something. So it's not a huge risk, but it is something we think about. But essentially, when you listen to the show, it's kind of people debating or challenging or opining on big things that usually aren't subject to day-to-day changes. But sometimes they are.
Yeah. No, you've been in the business for a while now. In your experience, in your career thus far, is there an interview or a moment that particularly stands out for you as, say, validating the decision to go into this line of work?
Wow, that's a big question.
Do you encourage people,
mm-hmm.
Young people especially, to go into your business? Because it is a volatile business. As we started the conversation talking about the state of the CBC.
Yeah.
I mean, that's every newsroom in the city, private, public newspapers, TV, radio.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a stable business. Do you encourage people to go into your line of work?
I don't know. I would encourage people to think about how difficult a business it is.
It's not all glamour and makeup.
Oh, God, no. It's not glamour. It's not makeup. It's not a lot. Let me list all the reasons not to go into journalism. So it's not very glamorous.
It's not six figures.
It's not a lot of money. Depending on the person, you're often considered like the worst kind of thing. Like there's parasites and then lawyers and then journalists and then all of the decent humans that populate the earth. That to some people. Although, but then there are those people that think journalists are the greatest thing ever, which is kind of nice. There is the CBC core that loves every bit of the people that work on the CBC, so that's kind of a boost as well. But I know a lot of people would say, never a better time to be a journalist. Come on, mm-hmm. the Fourth Estate's got to hold them to account. But be realistic. Like if you're listening and thinking you want to be a journalist, just be realistic. It is a valuable thing to society and the public and democracy. It's something that we need and something that will continue to exist in some form. It's not an easy thing to do, and you have to have a lot of passion for it. On the other hand, there's nothing really wrong with going to journalism school, because I'll tell you what'll never run out of demand is demand for spin doctors and corporate PR people, which you can do just fine after coming out of J school. So, like, the decision to go to journalism school is not as fraught a decision as whether to become a journalist.
Do you find that? I mean, the people that you graduate with, say, how many of them ended up in journalism as opposed to, say, ended up in PR?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think I don't have, like, hard stats, but I'd say of my graduating class, probably a third of us went into journalism. A third of us went off and did other things, and then a third went into PR and communications. And then as time goes by, more and more people leave journalism and go into communications and PR. For the simple reason that, one, there's way more money, and two, life is probably a little bit less stressful. Like, life as a working journalist is a stressful thing. It's a lot of work. There's not a lot of prestige involved. So it's natural to kind of think, like, you know, I kind of want a house and kids and some general life happiness, and so maybe journalism isn't right for me. I think that's the general progression.
Do you want to answer that question, but career-wise, what for you has stood out in terms of...
I honestly can't, like, I can't pick one moment, because there are...
So there are no regrets then, right, going into this business?
Oh, no. No regrets. I can't pick one moment that I've thought, man, this really validates everything I've ever done. But sometimes it's just as simple as, and again, this might seem weird, but no, it's those little moments, like when you genuinely get someone to laugh on the radio, or you genuinely get someone to cry on the radio, or someone just writes in and says, hey, I really enjoyed that story. As long as there are human beings out there who are getting some kind of value from what journalists are doing, then you feel good about it.
You know, we've talked for nearly an hour, and I've kept you longer than I said I would, but it's always fascinating to talk to you, and I'm sure people listening to this will have found the conversation the same. I appreciate you coming in to do this. You really didn't have to, but it's, as I said, it's always good to see you, and thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Twitter handle is @Lazen_writer. The website from our cbc.ca/the180. Matthew Lazen, writer, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.